I said he was the most unusual philosopher I know, and that's true, because he's the only philosopher I know who's done three tours of duty with the Royal Marines, one of them Northern Ireland, is that right?
Mostly quite.
In which you were trying to subdue my fellow countrymen. But anyway, so Tom, it's very nice to have you here. Thank you for coming. I'm delighted to see that you're not a PowerPoint fanatic, but instead believe in Gutenberg's technology. And over to you.
Great. Well, thank you very much, John, firstly, for the invitation, and I'll stand for this right and walk around as I talk. Just for those who are coming in as well, there's a handout right at the back, so hopefully everyone's got a handout. And also at the front, thank you. So I'm triply nervous about this paper that I'll give this evening. One is because I'm a philosopher presenting philosophy to non-philosophers, and I regret to say that philosophy sounds plausible once you're among other philosophers, but I frequently encounter these sort of raised eyebrows when I talk about my work to other people, so that's one reason for my nervousness. The second is that I'm not a technologist by background, so I'm coming at this as a generalist, a general intellectual who likes to look at things in detail, but I freely recognise this may be short on technical detail that some of you will have. But hopefully we can meet somewhere in the middle and have a fruitful discussion. And the third reason for my nervousness I just discovered beforehand when John whispered to me, they're an argumentative bunch. So so hopefully we can have some robust discussion afterwards. Okay, so I'm just coming to the completion of a PhD sponsored by Microsoft Research, looking at the notion of trust and how that works on the internet. And part of my background is as an epistemologist, so that's looking at the theory of knowledge, how knowledge works. And one of the growth areas in epistemology over the last 15 years has been a field called social epistemology. And social epistemology is this awareness that the classical conception of epistemology is Descartes' how do I know I'm not being deceived by an evil demon, rigorously individualistic. Social epistemology takes seriously the social dimensions of knowledge, you know, that much of what we know we depend on other people for. And in fact, almost all the interesting bits of knowledge that we have, we in some sense depend on other people, on our social context. And so this is a bit of practical social epistemology that I've been trying to do a bit of thinking about in terms of Google. Because Google and Wikipedia and related technology will be one of the defining epistemic tools that we have of our generation. And well, who knows what the future is. So the question that I'm trying to think about is, what are the epistemic consequences of search engines using the crowd to rank results, and hopefully I'll explain a bit more of that as we go in. But the basic idea, I mean, in epistemology, what we're interested in is true beliefs, and not just true beliefs, but beliefs that we know that something is true. Clearly, we go through a process of evaluating candidate propositions, or propositions as candidate beliefs in terms of what evidence they have for their truth or falsity. But we also have ways of coming across different propositions, sort of candidates that we're offered for our belief. You know, so this is also a very general description of something that's entirely humdrum. You know, you want to find out about the origins of life, you read a biology textbook, and during that process, the textbook is a tool for guiding you to propositions that you didn't previously know. Okay, and Google, it looks like search is going to be something like that. It's going to be a tool for taking you to propositions that you didn't previously know. You're offered them to be able to evaluate them for truth or falsity. So Google is at the moment has 90% of market share. These figures are about two months old, so it may well have changed up or down a few percent since then. But that's roughly, you know, it's a very strong monopoly. It's cornered the market. And Bing, Microsoft's sort of little competitor trying to claw back some of that market share, has got 4% in the UK. And it's bigger in the US. And the basic process, just in case there are any who are unfamiliar, is that crawler programs go out across the web, they copy whatever they see, they carry it back to Google, who then cache these, and these are then indexed. And then whenever you run a search, the search is run on the cache that Google has off the web. Now, just a little tidbit of information. So 68% of users, according to a recent study, believe that search engines are fair and unbiased sources of information. 62% of them are not aware of the distinction between paid and unpaid results. So remember, when you do a Google search, you'll see the sort of slight, there's a little background colour at the top here, which says that boots.co.uk is paid so that you'll search for boots. So their result comes at the top. And a further 45% of searchers would stop using search engines if they thought that the engines weren't being clear about offering some results for pay. So there's at minimum 7%, if we ascribe ideal rationality to people, there's a minimum 7% people who ought to stop using search engines. Okay, so what is the purpose of search? And just a little quotation there from one of Google's pages where they explain what they're about. Co-founder Larry Page once described the perfect search engine as something that understands exactly what you mean and gives you back exactly what you want. And Google's market share is very largely driven by the fact that it does that very well. And I'm sure all of us remember earlier searches where you just think, I'm searching for EasyJet, why doesn't it just give me EasyJet at the top? Like, how hard can it be? And Google does that very well. Now, how does it do that? Well, obviously the content of web pages provides the basic data for search. So what's actually written on the web pages that comes up. But the sheer volume of content online now means that this doesn't discriminate enough. You know, no one person can go through all of the web pages that match a particular search result. And obviously human nature being what it is, people want to get to the top of the results for whatever their purposes, benign or nefarious. And people started very quickly to get into the business of trying to game the algorithms. How can I put my web page at the top? And so you're putting things like pages full of white text, which you can't see, but obviously the algorithm picks up. So Google's key innovation was to start using forms of metadata generated by people's online behaviour to determine results. And the most famous one of these is PageRank. So every time that a web page contains a link to some other web page, in Google's algorithms, this counts as a vote in favour of the web page that it's linking to. So obviously you compute this across the web, and pages which have lots of links to them grow in importance, those with very few diminish in importance. And conversely, it can get more subtle, so that those pages which are linked to by lots of others are counted as significant sites, and therefore links from them to others also count as more important than links from the little minnows towards the big ones. And so what you've got there is you've got a way of computing how important people think web pages are by just looking. I mean, no one said, I think this is important, but a form of their behaviour online has sort of functioned as a signal to say that this particular web page is significant. But they've gone on to develop this, and another known technique is click-through patterns. So a particular set of results comes through on Google, and which result people choose to click through to and then stay on is then tallied by Google, and then they're able to say, you know, this is the one that people's attention is drawn to, so that when future people search for it, those results rise to the top and are top in relevance. And I'm not sure I've got the actual statistics, the exact statistics here, I'm afraid. But the significance of coming in those, I think it's 90% of searches don't go beyond the first three pages, and something like 60 or 70% don't go beyond the first 10 results. You know, it's a very high proportion. So it matters very, very much in terms of getting linked to that you be in those top 10 results that come up from Google. And one of the growing developments, personalised search. So when I type pubs into Google, I get a list of pubs in Cambridge. Okay, it's worked out that I live in Cambridge. And so it sends back results to me which depend on either location through IP address or previous results that I've chosen. So what I search for will now be different to what you search for. So that's just a general comment on this. So algorithms can compute letters and numbers, but what they can't do in and of themselves is interpret them. You know, they're not at this. I mean, until we've got strong artificial intelligence, who knows whether that will happen. What they're not doing, they're not in the business of interpreting the meaning. That's still something that only humans can do. But they are in the business of computing. And so the challenge is to try and find ways of computing that reveal something about meaning. And so in summary, this search, the way search engines now work, certainly Google, now piggybacks on human behaviour, which is processed relevance. This is a form of crowdsourcing. Right, so that's context. So I'm going to give three questions, criticisms about the epistemic effects of this practice of how search has developed in terms of basing search on users' behaviour. So I'd like to start sort of slightly more tangentially with, I'm leading up to a distinction between crowds and mobs. So there are times when groups can be incredibly, really strikingly more reliable than individuals. And the mathematical proof of this, very famous, is Condorcet's jury theorem. So the jury theorem states that suppose you have two options which an individual is forced to choose between. So in the jury theorem, is so-and-so guilty or not guilty? And suppose that each individual has a better-than-average chance of getting the right answer. It doesn't need to be by much. Even say, you know, six times out of ten, they'll get it right. When you get 12 jurors together, the likelihood that the majority will have got it right is actually very, very high. It's far higher than the simple 6 out of 10 that you might think it would be if you just aggregated across the individuals. And in fact, you don't need to increase the number very high at all until it approaches very, very close to 1. And so really oddly, it looks like you get a group of people together. So long as each individual just has a better than chance likelihood, probability of getting it right, the group as a whole is almost certainly going to get it right. And so what you should do then is just look at what the group does, and you just follow the group. Now, the way I've described it there is obviously it has some simplifying assumptions. So it's a binary choice, that, you know, there's two options, and it's assumed that each individual has the same probability of getting it right. And clearly those aren't very realistic assumptions. And I give a little reference there for a reference to ways that it can be generalised with much more realistic assumptions. So it doesn't actually need to be very robust. You can have many more options, and you can have a non-homogeneous group of people with very varied likelihood problems of getting it right. But so long as enough of them in there are likely to get it right, it turns out that the group will get it right. So that's it seems like groups are very strong. They give lots of evidence. Group consensus gives lots of evidence for the truth of what they have consensus on. However, there are some conditions for Condorcet's jury theorem to work and for the generalisations. So, crucially, each member of the group's judgment needs to be independent. So, a way of seeing this, so imagine all the economists agree that Britain is coming out of recession and... whatever the fiscal policy is that should come out as a result of that. Now, if all the economists are responding independently to the data that's coming forward that they've received, this may well have something that's got something very significant to say for it. The trouble is, if all the economists that we pay attention to have all been trained by the same teacher, who's all taught them to interpret the data in the same way, it looks like the fact that the group of economists as a whole has consensus on a particular diagnosis is no longer has any evidential significance. I mean, it's not that it's insignificant, but it's no more significant than if this one person, this teacher, had interpreted and come up for that. So each individual's judgment needs to be probabilistically independent of the other person's. And so I'd like to make a distinction between crowds and mobs. I just want to try and drive this home intuitively. I mean, I don't know what field each of you work within, but you'll often find there are key opinion formers in a particular field. And if so-and-so says it, my goodness me, then the word spreads around. And I think intuitively we can see that the fact that within a subfield, which is owes its opinions very substantially to the words of one or two people, actually, the value of the group's opinion is no more valuable than that one person who's at the top. So I'd like to distinguish between a crowd. So in a crowd, each member's judgment is probabilistically independent of the other. And conversely, in a mob, members' judgments are probabilistically dependent on a small or even a single opinion former. And the distinction is what philosophers call stipulative, so I'm not trying to describe what actual mobs and crowds are like. Clearly, actual groups of people can behave in different ways along the spectrum, and they're also responsive to other factors. So it's stipulative in that sense, and the distinction is also vague. So there's not going to be a clear boundary between when a group is a crowd or when a group is a mob. There's going to be lots of sort of different steps along the way. So you have groups of people that are more crowd-like and groups of people that are more mob-like. Okay. So I'd like to put this distinction to work in terms of thinking about Google. So a situation that we very often find ourselves in epistemically is that we want to find the truth of a proposition, P or not P, and you can either try and go and learn it yourselves, or what you can do is find someone who actually knows about this and then ask them to tell you, and they can tell you what's going on, and you can learn, called an expert. So the question is then how to find the right expert, right? Okay, because experts don't always agree. More's the pity. There's a reference there to Alvin Goldman, who's a social epistemologist, who gives five ways for a novice, someone who doesn't know the truth of the matter, to attempt to decide which expert to trust when experts disagree. And I'll just run through these quite quickly. So, trial by argument, where expert A, expert B have a little ding-dong, and the one who's kind of seems like he's left standing at the end wins. Weight of numbers, how many experts align with one versus one opinion versus another. Peer review speaks for itself. Disqualification through bias, if you've been paid by a tobacco company to testify that tobacco is not addictive, there's a question. And obviously track record of success. So these are what I'd like to call first-order methods of discrimination. However, there is a second-order method of discrimination. You can go to someone else who's done the work for you. In fact, you could even go to a crowd who's done the work for you, and you could ask them, you could follow what the crowd says. So the crowd, if each individual member of the crowd has done the work on those first-order methods of discrimination, you've got another way that you can find the right expert who will tell you what's going on. And this is effectively what's happening when, in many situations, epistemic situations, where I'm going online, I'm going to try and find something out, and I've plugged my search into Google, and what I want from Google is a list of people, of putative experts, who I can then go to, and I can assess their testimony in philosophical parlance, what it is that they are saying publicly, and I can then make a judgment for myself as to whether this is likely to be true or not. And really what I'd like Google to do is take me to the right experts. The trouble is, the crowdsourcing methods of search, this is my first main thesis, are turning us into a mob rather than a crowd. And I hope you can see why that is. It's because the choices that I'm presented with, those first 10, those first 20 hits, are very substantially dependent on the choices that people prior to me who've made the search have done. And so there's a circularity in the process. Every time that people in the past have endorsed a particular hit, a particular website, I'm then offered these as top of the relevance tree. So my choice has become dependent on others' choice, and the piggybacking of search on users' behaviour creates a mob instead of relying on a crowd. So the tag, don't follow the crowd when it's a mob. So, two more. These are more questions, I think. So, a statement here from Google. Advertising on Google is always clearly identified as a sponsored link, so it does not compromise the integrity of our search results. We never manipulate rankings to put our partners higher in our search results, and no one can buy better page rank. Our users trust our objectivity, and no short-term gain could ever justify breaching that trust. I don't want to challenge that. I'm not
But I'm actually quite gullible, I think, all things considered. So I'll take Google at face value and won't challenge that. I'm sure others wouldn't. But it does seem to me that there's... this actually isn't enough to get around a closely related problem. So there's no such thing as the purpose of search. Do you remember Larry Page's quotation? The search engine gives you back exactly what you want. And so many people use search engines to find sites or on topics that they've seen advertised. They know what they're looking for. You don't have the URL, so you've not plugged it straight in. And they're using the search engine to get there. Now, if the probability that users who are searching on that basis will get what they want is high, which I think it is, I mean, you're going to recognise the site very quickly and just go straight to it. And assume that there's equal numbers of sort of people who are doing that, and also people who are more generally inquiring, and they're not quite sure what they're looking for, but they're looking for something in this rough region. The accuracy with which the former land on the right results is going to drown out very quickly the accuracy with which others, in the more general sort of laissez-faire sense of searching, are going to land on the right results. And so what you're going to see is that results, searches that are in that general area, are progressively going to bias towards those people who know what they're looking for and just need help to get there, rather than those who don't quite know what they're looking for but are just generally having a look around. And so the result of that is that sites that are not well advertised, there's not much sort of word of mouth about how people are going to get there, are not going to be selected, whereas those that are heavily advertised in, you know, in whatever other context, are steadily going to rise as a result. So it's not that, you know, I'm not saying that companies are paying Google in order to rise up their search rankings. It just is the case that if you spend a lot of money on advertising, you're going to get to the top of the top of the search engines. Or, and it doesn't even need to be advertising, it just needs to be, if you've made a splash, if you've said something provocative, if you've attracted headlines, you are going to attract search ranking. Your sites, you know, the sort of things that you're saying is going to attract attention and be promoted higher in the relevance rankings and search results. The trouble is, of course, how widely people are talking about you or how widely you're spending money on publicity doesn't correlate with the epistemic reliability of what you're saying. I mean, these two things are totally tangential. So the way search works is that it's not going to prioritise, it's not necessarily, I mean, it's not going to necessarily exclude, but it's not necessarily going to prioritise those experts who we want to come across. So that's my second, it's more a question. Okay, now a third question. Larry Page's comment, the perfect search engine gives you back exactly what you want. Now, this is great, and we've got the rise of collaborative web search. So one of Google's recent innovations, they're trying to sort of get websites to take up what they call the plus one button. The plus one button is a bit like the Facebook tag at the bottom of, you get at the bottom of pages, you like this question mark. The plus one button, you click on it, and that then sends to Google a vote in favour of the website. You know, I like this website. And then that vote goes into the page algorithm, which ranks how this page is ranked. Now, the trouble with giving you back exactly what you want is that humans have a very strongly confirmed, strongly confirmed results from social psychological literature, is that we like to have our existing opinions reinforced, and we search for evidence on that basis. And so you can see this very easily with Amazon, with the recommender systems. You know, you buy a book, and the books that you get recommended as a result are all the books which say exactly the same thing as the books that you've already bought. Oh, wow, this is fascinating. You know, I can read 10 books and all tell me the same thing. And the evidential basis for confirmation bias. Test exercise, subjects would be given a string of numbers 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and they're then asked, the task for you is to discover the rule that describes why those numbers are in that sequence and then what future numbers are compatible with that sequence. And it turns out that most people obviously jump to the conclusion that the rule is every even number should come from there. And so the methodology is you're invited to ask the experimenter future number sequences, and the experimenter will tell you whether they're compatible or not with the rule. And so invariably people say, so they've got 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, they go 12, 14, 16, 18, and the experimenter goes, yeah, and that's compatible with the rule. And they decide, I've discovered it, it's the rule is even numbers. And in fact, the rule is any sequence of natural numbers which are ascending. And so the discovery from this is that actually when you want to test hypothesis, what you need to do is test evidence that disconfirms rather than evidence that confirms. And so with personalised search, how that applies, the results you receive reflect others' confirmation bias, because you're being studied, sort of put into some sort of profile, and people of your profile have found this interesting and this interesting, this is where they've gone. And so what you are offered is what people like you have done in the past. So you're sort of you become trapped in this sort of echo chamber effect of like-minded people saying the same thing. And potentially even worse, depends how sort of doxastically strong-willed you are, you know, whether you hang on to your opinions at all costs or not. But the results you receive now reflect what you used to be interested in, and it becomes progressively harder to escape from that. So the tag here, don't follow the crowd when most of those in it are stupid. Now, I don't know how much I want to push this, and maybe we can come back to a discussion on this, because, there may be quite easy ways that you can just flip this round, and so if you want something that evades confirmation bias, you just find what the people on the opposite side of the fence are reading or where they're going to on other options. So there may well be a solution, but as things are, I think that's certainly a question. Okay, so just as I come towards a conclusion. So firstly, just a general qualification on this. So Google obviously guards its algorithms very, very closely, one of the tightly held business secrets. Now this does have the disadvantage that we can't know if what I'm saying here is correct. There's a degree of interpretation, looking at the general principles that we are given and how that works. Now, obviously, the advantage is that nobody can show that I'm incorrect either. But, it's always a merit for a philosopher. And I wonder if the questions here straightforwardly apply in non-epistemic context where it's not a question of knowledge that's at hand. And so there are situations in quite a lot of life where actually it's very helpful for society, for the crowd, to settle on one particular thing. And for that to then be, you know, the basis for how we act. And Nietzsche has seen this as it's really unhelpful to have VHS and Betamax sort of running simultaneously. We want one system which operates, which everyone can then buy into. And I've no idea. Maybe John could tell us if the right technology won out or not. But regardless of the question of which technology was right, it is helpful that we have one. But it does seem in non-epistemic context that the result of this is diversity gets ironed out, and it becomes harder to come across products, you know, things that are different. I mean, there are other facts as well in that, but one of it is the tendency for people to follow each other. So, just to try and sum up the point that I'm trying to make, obviously, I don't want to be overly dramatic, because Google is incredibly powerful. Like, it is the most incredibly powerful tool for finding out new information that, you know, we've seen for a long time. But it's a bit like if you've got the scent when you're hunting, the dogs that you can release on it will hunt that quarry down. I mean, if you know what you're looking for, Google will get you there. The question is more, if you don't know exactly what you're looking for, how helpful is search going to be in that context? And that's why I put in, just in the abstract that was summarising what I was going to say, that's why it's particularly
restricts the use of search for academics, because the whole point about what we're trying to do, isn't it, is that we're trying to go to places that are overlooked by others. You know, we're trying to see into the dark corners where, you know, the interesting or surprising or controversial truth may be, which is being overlooked for whatever reason. Or to change the analogy, you know, it's like you've got an incredibly powerful rifle, but you don't have the thermal imaging scope to direct it onto what it is that you should be shooting at. Do you recall Rumsfeld's comment in 2003? There's the things we know, obviously question mark, there's the things we know that we don't know, but it's what we don't know that we don't know that really scares us. And that it's that third category that I'm trying to suggest that there may be just there's a restriction on the epistemic usefulness of search as a result of the methodology that it's used. Now, the problem is not what comes at the top, because no one's been forced to trust us, and everyone makes their own decisions for the leads they follow through, whether I take this to be plausible or not. The problem is that we don't know that. So as you get further down, you know, is this really the right things that I should be getting to, which I'm going to give them? And if it's not, I don't. Search isn't going to get me to those places. Finally, is there a case for regulation? I don't know. I mean, regulation is always the sort of too easy cry. But this was a Pew report, 2005. This odd situation in which a growing population of users relies on technology most of them don't understand highlights the responsibility placed on search engine companies. They are businesses, in many cases extremely successful ones, but their effects on society are far more than merely commercial. One unexpected implication of our study is that search engines are attaining the status of other institutions, legal, medical, educational, governmental, journalistic, whose performance the public judges by unusually high standards because the public is unusually reliant on them for principled performance. Thank you, and I look forward to the session.
Thank you very much, Tom. Can I abuse my position in the kickoff? I think you're very restrained about Google and uncommonly fair-minded. My feeling is that they're much more manipulative than you think.
Okay.
I haven't done the experiment here, but I know of experiments done elsewhere where, for example, if you get 10 people to make a simultaneous identical inquiry on Google about something, for example, which has interesting ideological content, the odds are that the 10 people will get different results. So there is no as very good, there's no single Google anymore.
Yeah.
And the second thing is that there have been legal challenges to this notion that they don't put their partners. There are ongoing legal challenges to this idea they don't put their partners higher in the rankings. So I don't know. Of course, at the moment, I guess nobody knows whether these suspicions and allegations are indeed true. But we do know that there's a risk that already this colossal power is being abused in rather kind of sordid ways.
Yeah.
And I think my feeling is that probably Facebook is in the same business.
Yeah.
So you're an uncommonly fair-minded for a philosopher.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's helpful. I mean, yeah, no, I'd really value being pointed to some of that stuff.
I mean, when you're doing a dissertation like you are, you can't explore this territory because there's no evidence.
I mean, just on the first point, they may come back and say, well, I mean, that just is the consequences of personalised search.
Yes.
We are trying to give the individual what they want, and that's it. So I don't know if it's politically problematic, the results that were coming back.
It leads to my second question, then I'll stop. How does your work relate to, say, Cass Sunstein's? Stuff that Cass Sunstein had in his book Republic.com, because he explored a lot of this stuff about group decision making and so on.
Yeah.
And he's also argued, I think, quite forcefully that the risks of the internet becoming a set of non-intersecting ideological bubbles is actually real.
Yeah.
Is that
Yeah, I mean, I think that's closely related. I mean, so Sunstein's work, as I understand it, he's really pushing. I mean, his key bit of evidence is you look at the links to other blogs that blogs provide, and it turns out that if you're on the far right in American politics, you link predominantly to other far right blogs, and you give a smattering, you know, two or three links to the sort of ridiculous examples of left wing blogs as a caricature of what our opponents think, and you find exactly the reverse, which provides on the other side, and then obviously that's politics and repeats itself across all sorts of controversial domains. So in one way, this could be a parallel. I mean, it's a closely related argument for how search works, but search is more. I mean, with blogs, that's simple human behaviour. That's simple human tendency to want to hear what others who think like me are. You know, I want to listen to others who think like me rather than be exposed to contrary views.
So search, in that sense, is different.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Comments? Arguments?
Could raise one question. I mean, on the internet, I think there is almost anything, every sort of information, right and wrong, has been put somewhere.
Yeah.
So how on earth can a search engine return the right bit that you actually wanted? I mean, it's an impossible task. It's the haystack. We've not even said what the needle looks like.
Yeah, I mean, it may be the conclusion that this just isn't something that's possible for a humanly contrived contraption to do. I feel that would be a pity because the potential is so great, and if it's simply a case of taking people where they want to go and they already know where they want to go, then we're effectively falling back on old-fashioned conventional human forms of experts who guide you to knowledge.
But I mean, things like Wikipedia do help because then you have some more trust in the validity of what's being said.
Sure.
Well, that's partly because the Wikipedia process is more open. You can inspect the edit history of every page, whereas you can't inspect the machinations of Google.
But if you restrict Google's search to Wikipedia, does a pretty good job. When it turns out adverts for DIY shops, you can smell the rat.
Yeah.
To counteract the bias of personalised search, would using the proxy IP help you much in that case?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm busting up to the limits of my technical stuff there, but presumably it would. But how many people know how to do that? I mean, that's the corollary, isn't it? So whatever solution we give has to be a solution that non-technical illiterates are able to access.
Is there scope for more knowledge to be put out that way?
I'm pessimistic about the ability of people to really. It needs to be delivered in an idiot-proof context, isn't it?
Well, in that context, sorry, I'll come back. In that context, the thing you quoted at the beginning, the statistic, was kind of staggering. That a significant number of people can't distinguish between paid search results and unpaid search results.
Yeah.
If that's accurate, it's scary.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
And it's something that Google were very, very careful about at the beginning to make it as obvious.
Yeah.
And they resisted a lot of pressure, and there were other search technologies at the time which freely mixed paid content in with their search results.
Yeah.
And one of PageRank's adamant points, right, at the beginning was this was you were always going to be able to tell, it would never be. So it's interesting if people
think so. It'd be interesting to see, I don't know how you do it, but whether the interface, the design, has softened the distinction between sponsored links and the non-sponsored links. Because I would not be at all surprised if it starts as it's a big box. Whereas now it's sort of you hover over it and then a different background colour appears, but otherwise.
I'll come to you, Ed.
You probably know this book that's just come out in the space, The Filter Bubble.
I don't know.
Eli Pariser, he's one of the founders of MoveOn. And his claim in that book is that since late 2009, Google has been using persuasion profiles with 57 variables to direct every search.
Right.
So that what you were saying about Amazon has basically been poured onto this Google platform. So it just started as an escalation of some sort of concern that everybody's kind of involved with their self-reinforcing link world. But the thing that I wanted to ask you is, can you think of, imagine reform measures that come out of philosophy proper? And there's a lot of things that might be candidates for that, but one that I would think of is an insistence coming out of academia of the more rigorous separation between searching and advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And a second might be the obligation to, when you're providing a kind of a public service for transparency,
mm-hmm.
so that they would in fact be obligated to finally publish their algorithms and explain how they update them weekly and how the persuasion profiles actually work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the obvious reply, their reply on the latter is their corporate success depends on it. I mean, it'd be like asking pharmaceuticals to disclose the recipes for their big new drug input.
I don't know why that. I don't follow that logic at all.
Because
you can always reverse engineer pharmaceuticals, and you can devise your own algorithm.
Yeah.
And they would continue to win if they're succeed if their service is better, which is how capitalism is supposed to work.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I think a more compelling argument on that is that if you publish the algorithm, it is easier to gain, and therefore it is less likely to be independent and accurate and so on, because as soon as any particular one is published, there are very large financial incentive for people to corrupt the results. And so there is an argument, I mean, being fooled by it, but that by keeping it secret, they are doing the public a great favour, because if it were public, it would be much more influenced by commercial interests.
Mm.
Sorry.
I mean, I typically take the point that there is just straightforward an ethical mandate for transparency, and we shouldn't be being sold advertising sponsored links, which we don't know.
Can we park that issue and come back to it, because I think it has an interesting dimension as well. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, John. It's refreshing to have someone talk about anything these days from the point of view of epistemology. With the World Wide Web and engines such as Google, you're really highly restricted in the dialogue that you engage upon. All you can do is come up with a couple of keywords, and essentially pose the question, have you got anything about this stuff, or some ordering of this? That's on that side of the dialogue. On the other side of the dialogue, the people who have prepared websites have no notion, or other than the most banal, I've got something to sell, I want to contact people to buy it. But generally speaking, people have no notion of the questions that are going to be posed to them. So, how significant do you think it is that in that interaction, people are denied the possibility of posing a question? Or stating what type of information, what type of proposition they are seeking. It looks like we're dealing with a one-size-fits-all, extremely crude mechanism. If we're talking about the general attempt to increase human knowledge, the question is, how significant is the denial of
I mean, is your thought we should go in and we should ask a question, a formed question, and the engine
would return? Yeah, you could be more informative about what it is, how you present what it is. It could be a question.
Yeah.
It could be as simple as, has anybody got this stuff about, which is what we can do now.
Yeah.
Or it could be more precise, a question, a particular question you're looking for an answer for.
Yeah.
In which case, people preparing material for websites might anticipate questions. present them in a way that they are, as it were, lined up to answer the questions.
Yeah.
But at the moment, we have an utterly crude mechanism.
Yeah.
And you frighten us to death by saying that this is actually the main thing.
I mean,
is it significant?
Yeah, well, I mean, I wonder if it'd be worse if we did actually go in type form question and we get a series of responses back, because it seems like the the potential for that to be everything that you presumably in a context where the technology was powerful enough to do that, the natural language processing was powerful enough to think in those terms, the answers are going to be tailored to that. Whereas at least at the moment you do have that element of randomness that things are going to go off at tangents, which actually is quite helpful. So I'd be reluctant to attach a huge significance, but I don't know if you would disagree on that.
Somebody at the back first, I'll come to you then. Michelle.
Could you see Google actually ever offering a subscription-based service where you can actually pay a monthly subscription and perhaps put in more metadata about yourself and what kind of information you're interested in, what academic level you might be looking for, so that Google can then take that and apply their search criteria better?
Mm. I mean, aren't they doing that anyway?
They're not taking money out of me at the moment.
Yeah. No, but they're taking the information. Yeah.
Yeah. But sometimes it'd be nice if you could filter it yourself.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you might want a very technical question answered, but other times you might just want a very general answer. It'd be nice to be able to say in your advanced search menu, what kind of information, what level you're looking for.
Yeah.
And I don't want to pay for I don't want to view any ads on sponsored links. And I'm happy to pay £5 a month for the privilege of not getting advertisements.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I've no idea, obviously, what Google's business plan is, but isn't the basic economics, they should be giving us something in return for our information.
Yeah.
And I would be willing, people are increasingly being willing to pay not to be advertised to. That's the sort of dynamic. Or some sort of extra special service that comes along. Whether people would pay not to be advertised to would be an interesting question.
That's a very good question.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting, very interesting. Thanks, Michelle.
No, after you. One more.
I didn't have a question. I was just following up on this gentleman's point about the sort of blindness of web content production. And in fact, I work as a user experience designer, and part of that, what I'm particularly interested in the moment, is tailoring the arrival somebody on a website so that I am delivering what they've looked for. So maybe they don't ask a natural language question when they search, but I'm able to look at the analysis of logs of what people search for, so their search terms and frequencies of search terms and clustering of search terms, that kind of thing, to try and figure out what intent people have arrived with. So then I'm not just sitting there with some content hoping people find it, hoping Google indexes the right bits, but I'm trying to push the most relevant bits of content according to what I've seen in analyses towards the people, so that pushes it, makes it more relevant.
Is that towards the general public in order to maximize the number of hits on the site, or is it for some altruistic reason whereby you want to provide the best service? To an epistemologist, things like, is such and such true or not? What is the evidence for this are important questions. Now, epistemologists are pretty thin on the ground. So in the mob culture that you described, Tom, your sorts of queries are going to be on page 150 of a Google search, if you're lucky. And as the thing grows and grows, and those pages grow in number, you're very likely to be able to engage meaningfully in this aspect of human life. Instead, this carry on will carry on and just grow until it bursts. So I'm wondering whether there's a scope for being, whether it will evolve into something more discriminating.
Mm. So now, I mean, I wonder if
there is actually a website called True Knowledge, and they actually give you a follow through of So you can ask a question and it gives you a follow through of how it reaches the answer. So that's close to possibly to you know, what you're meeting. The other thing I was wondering about is so obviously you have a very interesting hypothesis. How could you try and prove that this is indeed a problem? I mean, it might well be a big problem, but for anyone to really, anyone like Google and the rest of the world to get really interested in this, you need to show that this is really indeed a problem. And I was just wondering how you could set up an experiment to test this. But I know this is not the field that Mark does, but I think. These days we have so much more access to information than we've ever had. So even with the amount of bias that the information is given to us, maybe we don't actually care if there is bias. I mean, we're exposed to biased information when we hear the news on the radio, watch anything on TV. We're constantly bombarded by biased information. And why would we care that this happens on the web, where actually we know this is the platform where we can actually access information more than anywhere else? So that was one thing I was wondering.
Yeah. So two things there. I mean, in terms of absolutely right, an excellent challenge. How can we substantiate this empirically? And I butt up against the limits of my discipline there, I'm afraid. So I'd be really interested in talking to anyone who has the wherewithal, the intellectual ability to do that. In terms of the... the second one was...
Was the bias.
Yeah, the question of bias, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we probably will just learn to live with it. Like, we're quite adaptable, aren't we? But having said that, those epistemic institutions that have endured over time, universities, you know, potentially even the BBC, the reason they're so valuable is they work so hard not to be biased. So when there is, in this case, a new epistemic tool, new epistemic institution... I mean, we could just accept the fact that it's biased and it'll go the way of the Daily Mirror or whatever. It's something that crops up information which we sometimes have to rely on, but you know we know it's not perfect. Or it can become something that's really valuable, and in some sense is doing that work of filtering for us before you get to it. So I suppose that would be my quick response.
Could I sort of follow up on that? Because I mean, essentially, what is happening, what has happened, is that in this case, a particular commercial company has acquired really significant power. There's no question about it. I mean, Google can make you invisible. If it, and we know that because of the way it tweaks its algorithms, and you can see the wave of the consequences that then spread out across the web. People whose businesses disappear overnight because they can't be found anymore on Google and so on. So this is an organization that already wields really significant power, market power as well as others. Now, as far as I know, there has never been a case in human history of an organisation that had serious power that didn't abuse it, which is why we've always had, in the end, the question of regulation. And the only answer there is at the moment from the unregulated search engine community is, well, yes, it is true we have power, but there's lots of competition in here. And so if people think we're abusing it, then they can go to Microsoft's Bing or somewhere else, Yahoo maybe, or wherever. But the reality of it is that even in that case, I don't buy that argument, not with a 90% share. And secondly, I am pretty sure that our dear friends in Microsoft running Bing are up to the same racket as Google, and vice versa.
John, surely not.
No, of course not. apart from the bit of Microsoft that supports Tom's research. But the point is that that's not a convincing argument. So we have this very strange position where we have grown companies, commercial companies, which have colossal power and are effectively unregulated at the moment. And Whether that can continue or not is a really interesting question. And secondly, it undoubtedly has, in the end, political implications.
Mm.
So the kind of the questions you're asking have, in the end, a serious political dimension. It's not. I'm sure in your research, it's not your job to. You don't think it's your job to explore this, but it is somebody's job to explore that stuff, because one day it's going to haunt us. I think. Sorry, end of rant.
I feel bad I'm coming up too much of a Google fanboy here, but I think there's a counter-argument, which is, are there any organisations, any commercial organisations, which have been so dependent for their business model on trust of the majority of people, to the extent that if they ever betrayed that trust, their business model would be destroyed? Now, we may argue we don't know whether they've betrayed that trust, but if they start giving you back the wrong results, then that's at the very basic level.
How about banks?
Banks? Right, banks are... Yes, okay. Object lesson.
Yeah, they're too powerful to ignore. I mean, they are giving us the wrong results. I mean, I came in part because of your comment and the publicity that came out that Google's been less satisfactory. Was it you that said that? Or somebody said that?
Yeah.
Over the last 2 years, that's very much my experience.
Yes.
It's already in decline, but we don't have a choice now because of the positioning of it. Which is why I think some kind of transparency or some other philosophically based legislative activity is really essential now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we should be the ones that are figuring out how to provide the arguments for a nuanced, not a stupid, but a nuanced, bringing them out into the public sphere.
I mean, in general, that's the way in which regulation of monopolies eventually works, in the sense that they're forced to comply with certain kinds of things, even if they are commercially disadvantageous to them. But we're nowhere near that at the moment, partly because our legislatures and our regulatory bodies and so on are so far behind that curve, I think. I suspect. Sorry.
That's good. Yeah. Sorry.
The representative of Google will just speak again.
No, actually, that's a serious question. Just as a quick aside, your thing about it's great if you know what you're searching for reminds me of a nice quote Albert Einstein said, if we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be research. But the thing that's always worried me about the web is often the sort of loss of serendipity, right? The great thing about reading a newspaper was the things that you read that you didn't buy that newspaper to read. It's the thing that happens to come next to it, the column that you're really interested in that you end up reading and educating yourself by accident. And I suppose in the Arcadia context, it's true of libraries as well, right? The book next to the one you went to the UL to get is always more interesting than the one you actually went to get. But I guess the next stage of that is the thing you mentioned about the 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 example. The best way to test something is to find out about the counter examples. And I'm trying to think whether there's a way you could build a search engine that's deliberately. I think most systems try to introduce some aspect of serendipity. They deliberately throw in random results. Recommendation engines say, hey, people who like you like this kind of music. People who, like things you like also like this kind of music. And here's a few random ones we'll throw in just in case. But I wonder if you could build a search engine that deliberately looked at all your normal preferences and then went out of its way to say, but you might also like to consider the opposite point of view. And I don't know.
You could do that.
Do you think it could be done?
Only way I can think of doing that, because unfortunately, I mean, there is work that tries to look at what people are saying about, a sort of emotional analysis of links to other sites, whether your company is viewed positively or negatively in the world. And you mentioned this idea that very right-wing sites might have links to very left-wing sites, saying how ridiculous this is. And maybe you could then deliberately detect that and offer those links as part of the results to people who might otherwise bias towards, right? And the problem with this, of course, is that most people wouldn't actually want that.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to build a business on it, but I wonder if you could build an academic project on it.
Yeah. I mean, because
what you might be able to build a business on is to do what you just said, but take the initiative away from the search engine and to the searcher. whereby we all form a company now today which will develop a piece of software whereby you can explain whether you're feeling right-wing or left-wing today, whether you want to buy a bar of soap or find the meaning of life, whereby the web is then interacted with by something in our control rather than in the control of this banal device, the search engine.
Because Google's response to some of this might quite rightly be, well, look, we've got this advanced search page where you go in and you get to choose to specify much more tightly what the parameters are that you're searching.
That's all like what I was saying about focusing my own personal preferences, who I am, more than what Google assumes I am,
yeah.
So that I can get better search results.
Yes, for that particular piece of information, it should be your information, our information, the user's information, not Google's information.
Mm-hmm.
You're asked to fill in the form according to the Google manifesto. Do you see? Or your habits are studied by Google and then anticipated, which is all the wrong way around.
But how are the pages then matched to that wish that you've expressed? You express one wish by saying, I'm right-wing and I'm a consumer today. You express another wish by your choice of keywords. But then what mechanism matches those expressions
to
the pages?
It would be up to the provider of the search engine to match the wishes of the user. So, oh gosh, everybody now is coming at us, instead of three keywords, we're now getting these profiles with questions. And do you see? So we're going to have to modify our algorithms in order to be able to provide the left-wing view today, the right-wing view. You agree all?
Oh, I see. So it's residential. So you're indexing.
Yes.
Yes.
At the moment, it's entirely in the hands of the...
Can I offer a simple engineering solution to that problem, which I have myself invented, which is I buy stuff for my kids on Amazon as well as for myself. And you would not believe what that does to Amazon's recommend rate.
Serious epistemologists only to be reading this. I don't know. Because it doesn't want to be misunderstood, let's say.
No, that's fine, but the problem with the search engine is this constant dilemma between one end wanting the book not and one end wanting the crowd.
Mm.
And you can't do both.
Very interesting.
I think there's a big opening for a book on practical epistemology, by the way. Albert Rex. No, I haven't looked at the historical parallels, but is there anything that springs to your mind?
Not particularly. I'm maybe Ed or John Clinton.
Well, there's a Catholic Church, of course.
that's
some time ago, of course.
It's a whole wonderful series of dystopian novels. I mean, as you're talking, I think you think of something like Zagintin's We, when Britain and the Soviet Union was developing, and the idea that the system itself made you available to everybody, and you actually thought you saw everything, but actually there was a world outside you never gained access to. And there was always this looking for this subversive way of looking round the screen.
it's almost a bit Wizard of Oz-like. The principle about epistemology is about political action.
There's
places to look at novels like that, which provide plenty of good examples.
Yeah.
But they're essentially thought experiments, aren't they?
Because although epistemology in one sense is quite rarefied and sounds like it's the subject matter for the lab, it's political ramifications and ethical ramifications on it all.
Have
you had much dialogue with the search quality people at Google, Yahoo, Bing, etc.? Because some of these claims might have empirical answers to them, and they have a lot of people who are pretty fanatical about the quality of their results.
That
could be an interesting competition.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. And so my sort of key contact at Microsoft, he's had a busy few weeks, basically. But we're very much intending to get him to talk to Bing people about this. But there's, but I totally take the point.
It'd be very nice to have somebody from some of these guys from Google come and give a seminar here. Thank you for that idea. I hadn't had it before. Very good. Anything else? Okay, well, in that case, can I first of all thank you for coming, and thank Tom for a very entertaining, stimulating event. Will you just make one undertaking before you go, which is that when you've written your dissertation and it's been examined, that you'll put it on the web so we can read it?
Of course.
Right, thank you all very much. Please have a drink at the back.